You're listening to the Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on China's foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world, brought to you from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center here in Beijing. I'm Paul Hanley, the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, and I'll be your host. Today, we're privileged to be speaking with my Carnegie colleague, Dmitry Trenin, about the current crisis in Ukraine. Dmitry is the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center and is speaking to us by phone from Moscow. Dmitry, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Dmitry has been one of the leading voices helping the international community better understand the current crisis in Ukraine and the Russian perspective. Dmitry, we know you're very busy these days, and so we really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure.
Let me start, Dmitry. In one of your most recent articles entitled "The Crisis in Crimea Could Lead the World into a Second Cold War," you begin by warning that this is perhaps the most dangerous point in Europe's history since the end of the Cold War. You write that direct confrontation between Russian and Ukrainian forces will draw in the United States one way or another, and that while there is still time, it is extremely important to understand what each party is aiming for. Let's begin there. There seems to be a great deal of misunderstanding about the aims and the desires of the Ukrainian protesters who were in the Maidan and the hopes and wishes of ordinary Ukrainians. Can you help us understand, Dmitry, what is it that Ukrainians want and what are their aims?
Well, Paul, let me first say that I need to have some humility when discussing Ukraine, a large country that really demands special expertise. I'm not a Ukraine scholar, and I cannot claim any special expertise simply because Ukraine, for a few hundred years, used to be part of the Russian Empire and then of the Soviet Union. But from my perspective, from what I said in Moscow, I see three elements on the Maidan, which is a name for the movement in Kiev, the capital, that toppled President Yanukovych in February this year. In my view, the Maidan had three main elements. One is the common people who were drawn to Maidan, which is Ukrainian for independence, for square. Actually, it's called, the full name is Independence Square.
Mm-hmm.
They were drawn there by their opposition to the corrupt, very corrupt regime of President Yanukovych.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to that corruption, they saw an alternative in drawing closer to the European Union. Europe to those people meant basically two things: much higher living standards than in Ukraine, and the rule of law. So this is the most important, mm-hmm, in terms of the number of people involved, the element of the Maidan. On top of the Maidan, there is, or there used to be, a political icing, which was composed of the opposition parties, right, in the Ukrainian parliament, or the Rada. Now, these parties have, since the victory of the Maidan, formed a new Ukrainian government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me tell you very frankly that the parties making up the opposition were part of the same corrupt system that until recently had Mr. Yanukovych and his clan in its ranks.
Right.
If you like, it's the end of the regime of President Yanukovych, but not the end of the political system of which he used to be an integral part of.
Right.
These opposition figures have been on the political scene for a very long time. And some of them have been ministers in the previous governments. Some of them have been prime ministers, and they're all financed by essentially the same bunch of oligarchs, very rich people,
right,
who not only control the Ukrainian economy, but who also control the Ukrainian political parties through mm-hmm. their own informal factions in the Rada. Mm-hmm. So that's the second element. The third element in the Maidan is a new addition, if you like, to the Ukrainian political system, the radical forces from Western Ukraine. Those people grouped in the Freedom Party mm-hmm. and the Right Sector group, they fielded the most potent elements in the Maidan self-defense force, quote-unquote,
mm-hmm.
Who were, in many cases, very well-trained activists or militants who engaged the riot police in very serious fighting and yeah. managed to kill a number of well-equipped, highly protected riot policemen. So this is a very potent military
right.
force
right.
Who have managed to get hold of large stocks of ammunition and who are powered by the right-wing nationalist ideology, which is rooted in the 1930s.
Mm.
So those are the three elements of the Maidan. And if I were to summarize yeah. that just in one sentence, I think that most of the people in Ukraine, not just on the Maidan,
right.
want an end to corruption, or at least curbing the corruption, and the institution of the rule of law, which would lead to better opportunities for those people, better living conditions. Ukraine, it must be said, is the one country that in terms of its living conditions has not progressed much since 1990, since the downfall of the Soviet Union. Everyone mm-hmm. else, you look at Poland, look at Russia, look even at Belarus,
mm-hmm.
they have all gone up. Ukraine has been static, more or less. Now, the opposition wants to form, they are now in government. They want to have a confirmation of that in the national election. And basically, they want to move toward the European Union. However, this is a very long haul, given the conditions of Ukraine. These people, I think, are heavily dependent on the West. They're dependent for their survival, for their political survival, on Western economic assistance, on Western political backing. And their fate, however, will largely depend on whether they will be able to make living a little bit cleaner and a little bit better
mm-hmm.
for most Ukrainians, which will be extremely, extremely difficult. And finally, the nationalists would want to impose their own view of what Ukraine is, where it belongs, on the Ukrainian people as a whole. They think that the Ukrainian people have been spoiled a lot by their close relationship with Russia, linguistic, cultural, mental, and they want that change. They want a very different Ukraine from the one that has existed in the last few centuries.
Dmitry, you talked about the three main elements, very complex mix of factors and dynamics. Can I ask you to draw out a little bit more the balance of interests within Ukraine between the West and Russia as they look at their future? And how does this factor in to what has taken place in the Maidan in terms of their future desires and where they want Ukraine to go in the future? How is this delicate balancing act playing out?
Well, you need to appreciate that Ukraine is a very complex polity.
Mm-hmm.
It's the process of nation building, and various parts of Ukraine have very different identities. The western regions are perhaps most nationalistic. Those western regions have never really formed part of the Russian Empire. They were only included into the Soviet Union by Stalin at the time of the Second World War. They feel their brand of Ukrainianism, if you like, mm-hmm. Rejects things Russian. Russia mm-hmm. is essentially an enemy. Mm-hmm. You also have eastern and southern regions, which are Russophone, until very recently were happy to live within Ukraine, but their cultural and linguistic identity was Russian.
Right.
I walked around Odessa, a major seaport on the Black Sea, and in the 4 days, I was just walking along the streets. I only heard Ukrainian spoken once or twice, probably by visitors from the rest of Ukraine.
Right.
But as I said, they were happy to be Ukrainian citizens in this very loosely governed, Ukraine loosely stitched together.
Understand.
But, right. But right now there is, the choices have become so much starker. A tilt toward Europe mm-hmm. would probably mean an end, an economic, let me put it this way, not a political, ideological tilt toward Europe, but joining in a free trade area. Mm-hmm. with Europe mm-hmm. would probably mean phasing out much of Ukraine's Soviet-era industry, which survives basically because of fairly low prices that the government charges them for gas. In that case, people understand, and Russia made it very clear that mm-hmm. An economic integration with Europe, even within a deep free trade area, would mean cutting many ties between Ukraine, economic ties between Ukraine and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
The result is likely to be that a lot of people in southern and eastern Ukraine are likely to lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what makes people very anxious about the future.
Sure.
And to them, a continuation of the present situation in which much of Ukraine's trade is with Russia. Ukraine trades more with Russia than
right.
with the European Union.
Right.
And these people feel that they can lose even the few things that they have
mm-hmm.
if Ukraine should head west. So
right.
these people would be interested in continuing relations with Russia, not because of linguistic affinities or cultural whatever,
mm-hmm.
but because of how they see their economic future.
Dmitry, let me turn, if I could, to Russia and talk about the Russian position. You wrote in an article in the New York Times on February 23rd that you did not think Russia would interfere in Ukraine. Now, with Russia's intervention in Crimea, the region is witnessing its biggest crisis since the breakup of the Soviet Union. Can you give us a sense why you think Putin intervened in Crimea? Can you help us understand Putin's thinking a bit better?
Well, titles of articles are the privilege of the editors, and I had the good or bad fortune of writing at the crunch time. You said that the piece appeared on February 23. I actually wrote it on February 21.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the night of February 21, actually in the morning of February 22, something fundamentally important and unforeseen by me happened, and that was that the agreement between President Yanukovych and the opposition, with the European foreign ministers acting as witnesses,
right,
in the presence of a Russian representative also, they signed an agreement that would have foreseen gradual, a delayed surrender of the Yanukovych regime, elections by the end of the year, a new constitution with reduced power of the presidency, etc.
Right.
Now, that agreement, despite its signature by the president and the opposition leaders, and their, let's say, confirmation, or some people say guarantees from the European foreign ministers, this agreement did not last more than a few hours.
Right.
When it was presented to the Maidan, and that's very important, a member of the right sector, a fairly lowly member of the right sector, stepped forward on the platform of the Maidan and said, we don't want that agreement.
Right.
We want President Yanukovych out now. And the Maidan supported him, and the opposition withdrew its signature from the agreement. The Europeans said nothing, and President Yanukovych fled the capital. So that was so amazing, so dramatic.
Not predictable.
So unforeseen.
Yeah.
Right. So that, that to me, that was a sea change in Russia's policy toward Ukraine. I argued, and I still argue, that right up to that point, Russia was pretty passive in its approach to Ukraine.
Yeah.
It was, well, it was trying to lure Yanukovych to its side. It showed him the stick. First, it demonstrated how painful the severance of economic ties with Russia would be for Ukraine.
Right.
And then offered the carrot in the form of a $15 billion assistance package plus a reduction by 30% of the gas prices. And that was given to Ukraine, no strings attached, as it were, just to help it buy, to help it go through a very difficult period, in the hope, of course, that eventually Ukraine would become part of Mr. Putin's Eurasian Economic Union. Now, what happened in the morning of the 22nd of February was interpreted in Moscow as utter chaos descending on Kiev. And, you know, people in amazement saw no police in the street where there had been battles for days. They saw the presidential palace abandoned. There was no trace of the of President Yanukovych for a few hours. So there was complete, and then the only force in the street were the heavy, well, were the trained and armed people from the right sector who had their own enemies to chase. And there were cars on fire and things like that. So I think that Putin was persuaded that what was coming after this standoff and this surprise would be something like fascist dictatorship, quote unquote. He has, and not only Putin, a lot of people have who have looked at the ideological underpinnings of the right sector drew parallels between that very distinct brand of nationalism and the fascism of the 1930s. So they had the anxiety in the Kremlin was very high. And then I think Putin, who, and I noticed that Putin even last year stopped being 100% pragmatic on Ukraine. He adopted a civilizational perspective. To him, Ukrainians and Russians were one people. So when he saw what he saw in Kiev in the morning of February 22, that he received a message that our own people are at risk and we have to protect them from a bunch of fascist thugs. But he also had developed in the last couple of years, and the historic mission, if you like, of rebuilding the Eurasian power sector, power center, where virtually all Ukraine, minus its western provinces, if it must, fully belongs. In western Ukraine, Putin is absurd or perverse. And he, I think, started to act as if he was presented with a national security threat of the first order on hands. What we saw in Crimea certainly was in response, the way the people reacted around Crimea against the new authorities in Kiev and the people who reacted in eastern and western parts of Crimea, that a lot of that was spontaneous. Mm-hmm. What was not spontaneous is the action of the Russian government. I think it had been well thought through, well prepared reaction, and what we saw was an operation to secure Crimea, seal it off from Kiev, from the rest of Ukraine, so that whatever happened in Kiev would not touch Crimea. So that's that to me explains this change in Putin's behavior from relative passivity, actually high degree of passivity, to going into high gear almost immediately when he was surprised by something which had not been foreseen, and when he had to react as if it was the most serious national security threat that he faced in the West, on the western borders of Russia.
That's
my explanation.
Thank you. And you talk about the events on the Maidan on February 22nd as having a significant impact on President Putin's thinking of with respect to what was happening in Ukraine. Can you give us a sense whether or not it has changed to the extent that many people are asking, will Putin stop at Crimea, or is this a stepping stone to taking all of Ukraine? Do you have a sense of how President Putin's thinking has evolved with regard to that question that many are asking?
Well, I think that for Putin, all of Ukraine, except for the several western provinces of Ukraine, as I refer to them as never having belonged to the Russian Empire, never fully socialized in the Soviet Union.
Right.
The bulk of Ukraine belongs with Russia / Eurasia, as does Belarus, as would at least Transnistria, if not whole of Moldova.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's Putin's worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what his aims are with regard to the rest of Ukraine, I think having secured Crimea, and I don't think he will step back. I don't think that he will call off the referendum. He cannot formally do that. I don't think that he would not accept what I think is likely to be the result of the referendum in favor of reunification with Russia. It would be inconceivable for me at this point that Putin were to say, no, we cannot accept that for geopolitical reasons or because the United States doesn't want us to have Crimea as part of the Russian Federation. But beyond Crimea, I think Mr. Putin would prefer a federalized Ukraine in which Ukraine's various regions would have a large degree of autonomy.
I see.
Western regions, southern regions, eastern and central regions. And Ukraine itself would become a federation, which would prevent Ukraine, because of the importance of the eastern and southern regions, which would prevent Ukraine from going all the way to the west. Mr. Putin's biggest worry, biggest potential threat with regard to Ukraine for many years has been Ukraine's potential membership in NATO. This is something that a federalized structure would be able to prevent. It would also be able to prevent the spread of nationalist Western Ukrainian ideology on the whole country. It would protect the use of the Russian language in the areas where Russians form either a majority or a significant portion of the population. So that's, and that would also protect the some of the economic ties between Russia and Ukraine. So that's, I think, that's Putin's objective with regard to Ukraine. For him, Ukraine is not lost. Ukraine is still something worth fighting for, worth supporting pro-Russian elements or Russian-speaking elements in Ukraine. For Putin, this is fully legitimate in the sense of supporting, as he would put it, supporting our own. Ukrainians and Russians, as you said, are one people, after all.
Dmitry, I want to turn now to the West and the United States. As you have predicted, the United States has been drawn into this conflict. You and our Carnegie colleague Andrew Weiss recently argued that Western appeals for Russian restraint are unlikely to resonate. Why is it, in your view, that Western threats of isolation, sanctions, other measures are unlikely to be effective? Why is the West unable to isolate Putin?
Well, I think that the West can isolate Putin as a person from itself. There is unlikely to be a G8 summit chaired by Putin in Sochi, as the summit was planned for June this year. There may be fewer summits between Putin and other Western leaders. I think a lot of people in the West will shun Putin and members of the Russian government. So you only deal with them when you absolutely need to deal with them. Maybe you would prefer the phone to a direct encounter because you wouldn't want to be photographed with the Russian president. So that is not only possible, I think this is something that's happening. Now, isolating Russia is a much more difficult task, and is something that will come with a price tag. The price tag will be biggest for Europe, which does depend on Russian energy supplies to a significant degree. But Europe also sells a lot of stuff to Russia.
Right.
Russia is a big market, and a lot of European, for example, automobile companies would not want to lose the Russian market. Russia is also a purveyor of some important ingredients such as titanium for the international, for the, let's say, Western aircraft industry, including the Russian element of the Boeing company, or say the technological center that Boeing has in Russia, is the biggest technological center that Boeing has anywhere in the world outside of the United States. So there are, it's just a few examples. There are very important trading links that neither side wants to sever at this point.
Sure.
I'm not saying that they will be protected, but it'll be difficult.
Right.
It's also important. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
One country that does not appear to be moving to isolate Russia or to shun President Putin is China. And last week on the podcast, we interviewed leading Chinese scholar Dr. Su Hao about China's perspectives. China has remained on the sidelines of the crisis and appears torn over its interests and loyalties where they lie. On the one hand, as you know, China dislikes interference in others' internal affairs. On the other hand, it does not want to overtly support the overthrow of incumbent regimes, and it also dislikes what it views as Western and U.S. support for dissidents and color revolutions. So China looks to be playing a delicate balancing act with what I would say at this point is a slight lean towards bringing the United States down a notch. I'm wondering, Dmitry, how the Chinese position has been seen from Russia, and does Russia see China as being supportive, or are they disappointed by the lack of a more firm, supportive stance from the Chinese leadership? How is it viewed in Russia?
Paul, one maxim that is being repeated in Russia is a phrase uttered by Emperor Alexander III of Russia, who died 120 years ago this year, which read, "Russia has only two friends in the world, its army and its navy."
Mm-hmm.
China is not seen as an ally of Russia under these circumstances. China, I think, is perceived as a country which is doing what is best for itself.
Right.
In any circumstances, a country that walks by itself, a huge country, hugely important also country, that walks on its own. The reasons that you have described as informing the Chinese position, I think, are very well understood here. There is no urge for a Chinese support in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if Russian-Western relations, i.e. Russian-American and Russian-European relations, deteriorate to a significant degree, as I would expect them to, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
there will be more reliance on the Chinese in Russia for a number of reasons and in a number of areas,
right.
From economic to geopolitical. And then the trick for Russia will be to exploit this very important relationship, expand this relationship,
mm-hmm.
but not in such a way as to become more dependent on Beijing.
Right.
Again, I said it's not going to be easy, but of all nations in the world, of all important nations in the world, China will be, I think, the only one
mm-hmm.
with which relations will not be, well, India maybe another, but China is
right.
at this point more important to
right.
Russia than India in economic and geopolitical terms. So China will be the most important major power
mm-hmm.
to Russia,
mm-hmm.
And its importance will grow. If, for example, there is there are more difficulties for Gazprom in the European market.
Right.
Then the issue of gas price for China may be resolved easier and more on Chinese terms. That's just
Thank
to
you.
Give you one example.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast. If you'd like to read Dmitry's analysis and updates on the crisis in Ukraine, I encourage you to explore the Carnegie Moscow Center's website at www.carnegie.ru and follow Dmitry on Twitter, where he's very active at Dmitry Trenin. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.